Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. I'm on Capitol Hill, and you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. We are in Senator Dan McKay's office on the right. Welcome to the program, Dan. Hey,
thank you very much.
And Shireen Gorbani on the left.
Hello, nice to see you both.
Wow, Super Tuesday is done.
Yes.
A lot has happened. Can you imagine being in the Biden campaign after this turnaround?
Well,
whiplash.
He had a mass exodus of staff 2 weeks ago, right?
Okay.
Where people were kind of bailing to other camps and looking for other places. And then all of a sudden, everybody's trying to get a job back. And it was interesting to see I don't know that I've ever seen a campaign die and live and resurrect so quickly.
Like, yeah.
Interestingly.
Right. A really stunning turn of events. I want to get local commentary, but let's stay with the top line for just a minute here. Shireen, share with our listeners some of the dynamics that have happened. I mean, the Buttigieg, the Klobuchar, the Bloomberg.
Well, so we've seen a mass exodus of sorts. We were down to, five candidates? And then some of the definitely underdogs dropped out and basically immediately got on a plane to, I believe they were in Texas, joined Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg through his support. Amy Klobuchar, who had done a rally here, I think that was Monday morning, then same, basically.
Within 2 hours.
She dropped out like 15 minutes after the rally.
Yep.
That's been a really bad rally.
Right. I mean, given what happened with our vote totals here in Utah, yes, it probably was poorly attended. And then jumped down to Texas and got behind Biden. I think this is a really interesting, the thing that I'm finding curious about the conversation that's happening now is it's this sort of moderates coalescing. We keep hearing moderates coalescing. Mm-hmm. I think that's true in some cases, though there were many things that Pete Buttigieg was out there for that are, I think, far from moderate, or not far from moderate, but are, I would say are progressive ideas that he was holding. But what I do think is happening is people want to win. We want to win this election in 2020, and that is the most important thing.
Yeah. Dan?
I want new tires, and so I'm going to go to the store and buy an old tire and put it in my car because I want new tires.
You know, I think actually what it is people want health care, and they're terrified that the current person is going to take away health care. And so they'd like have someone who's fighting for health care.
And I think what's happening is they don't want Bernie Sanders because he can't win. But that's my opinion. Dan, I want you to give us your insights on Senator Warren. She's had an amazing impact on this race.
Yeah.
I think she, more than anybody else, hurt Bloomberg.
Yeah.
Who's now pulled from the race.
Yeah.
What did she get? Third in her state?
Third in her state.
Third in her state. So she wasn't doing that. And it's pretty clear to me that she's someone who gets things done. She's a doer. She's got some pragmatic record behind her. And it makes me think that a lot of her supporters see that, and that's why I think they'll go to Biden and not Bernie Sanders, because from what I see, Bernie Sanders has been a dreamer but hasn't really accomplished much.
Hmm.
Quick commentary from both of you.
Well, you're presuming. Okay, I go back to what Shireen said, and I think that's probably a good point. I think the Dems did have a wake-up moment, and it was probably last week, where everybody said, well, maybe it'd be better if we won, right? Mm-hmm. Might be better if we won. And so let's put together a candidate that can win, and let's go with Biden. I thought, in my opinion, I think Elizabeth Warren is a better candidate than Warren is, for a bunch of reasons.
Elizabeth Warren's a better candidate than Biden.
Than Joe Biden. And I thought she's a better candidate because I think she strikes the chord of, you know, the kind of the more centrist slash appeal to the candidate. I think of all the candidates that are in the race or are still in the race, she's most likely, in my opinion, to run again in 4 years after Trump wins the upcoming election. And so you're looking at those types of deals, right? And the funny thing is, Joe Biden is, well, let me go back to Elizabeth Warren. I don't know what it would feel like to be a presidential candidate and not win your state as the sitting
U.S. senator. No kidding.
US
and not even take second.
And not take second and not, you know what I mean? Like, now, I'm certain she'll be reelected. I'm not concerned about her reelection chances, that kind of thing. But I think that would be hard for
me. That's crazy,
right?
Did either of you see the Tom Friedman piece on the Unity Party?
No, I didn't.
Okay, so New York Times columnist, he basically writes a column where he says, come on, Democrats, unify, put together a slate of all of you in government service. So let's say Biden's at the top. Let's say Kamala Harris is the VP. Let's say Buttigieg is the Department of Defense.
Sure.
Let's put Kamala Harris as Attorney General, and let's have Amy Klobuchar as the VP. But he basically, you know, pulled together an idea that all of this talent should unify and say, we're the ones that are going to unify America and take care of it.
So
does that speak to you?
Well, Democrats are unified. There are many polls that show that we are very happy with the options that we've had in this race. I'm very happy with the options that we have going forward, because I do think what we're talking about here is electing somebody who's going to bring dignity back to this office, who's going to negotiate deals on behalf of the American people that are really for working class American people. I think that we're talking about a person who's going to expand and protect healthcare, or somebody who's not. And that is just going to be a good race for us, no matter who is at the top of that ticket. I think it's going to be about energizing different voters.
So, yeah. Shereen, do the Dems look here in Salt Lake at their selection of Sanders, and the fact that Biden, you know, is kind of leaping forward as the establishment? Mm-hmm. What does it say about Dems here in Utah compared to like this national establishment push to grab Biden is from a candidate standpoint?
So Democrats in Utah, we've talked about this before, but I think in 2016 it was almost 80% for Sanders.
Yeah.
We continue to see that in Western states, a very progressive populist strain of sort of new Democrats is taking hold across places like, we're definitely seeing it in Colorado, here, sometimes in Nevada, into California. And there is something about, I think, that sort of Western sense of populism, but there's also something really interesting about wanting somebody who feels authentic, out there fighting for you. There's something about that I think actually even resonates across party lines here in Utah.
I have to admit, I was watching the coverage last night, and as the time ticked on and finally you got the California and Texas ballots coming in, but when you saw the states that Sanders took, California, Colorado, Utah, Vermont, that's a strange mix of states for Utah to be in. And my son texted me this morning like, can you explain this to me, Mother?
See,
so can you guys explain this? I see Sanders as, you know, this this rebel and this person that carries, you know, this movement message. But you hear people talk, do we really need a revolution when we have a strong economy and low unemployment rate and so many good things happening?
Yeah, I think we still have. So we have a really big middle class here still. And I do think the middle class is getting squeezed in this economy. They just are. And if we can talk about maybe some of the elements of the amount that individuals are cutting, the checks that they're cutting each month on healthcare, and thinking about what a Sanders administration could mean to those families that can't afford their prescription drugs.
But Shereen, he can't do it.
Well, so
do you know what I'm saying? I mean, if he's in office, this is what I tried to explain to my kids as we talk about it, because we're just having this great family discussion, which I think is wonderful. But there's no scenario where I see he can land the compromises and the finessing necessary to make his vision happen. It's a split country. It's going to take some money who works on both sides.
It's a split
this
country.
Is not him.
It's a split. So I can understand that. I can definitely understand that.
You're
it
kind.
Is certainly a split country. I think when it comes to some of these core issues that people are struggling with at their kitchen tables, I do believe that people think somebody like Bernie Sanders is going to be on their side.
Yeah.
I'll just say this. The result last night is a key element for why we ought to have, at least in partisan races, especially primaries, we should have ranked choice voting.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it would be nice to see Utah's votes, even though they're Democrat votes, which are totally wasted. But that's a whole other issue. I'm just kidding. I just want to get a rise out of Shereen. Yeah, I just like to stick it to her a little bit. So I'd say if we got the ranked choice voting, you could see really who, you know, what ideal appeals to the top. Because I think if there's ranked choice voting, I think Biden or Warren would have won that race yesterday.
Wow. Interesting.
Biden or Mike Bloomberg. Because Bloomberg was in third.
Yeah.
And so I think with ranked choice voting, I think we would have seen a significantly different outcome than sending all of our delegates with this Bernie Sanders idea. But hey, Bernie Sanders is the ideal candidate for President Trump.
He wants him.
That is the way to go. And honestly, and I said this on the news last night, you know, one of the things that I would love is for there to be a conversation at the country. We're at a crossroads. We got all these people saying the government should do more. And we got some of these people, crazy people like me, saying the government should do less. Let's put that on a stage. Let them fight it out. And let's see where the country goes. I like that.
Yeah. No. I'm just cannot. These are the extremes going at each other, and I'm a productive middle person, and I see it as a dumpster fire, Dan. I just see it as tearing our country apart.
You're not mentioning Donald Trump got 88% yesterday. I noticed that you haven't mentioned that yet.
I am going to say, though, I will be very exhausted of older white men yelling at each other for the next few months.
Yeah, imagine this. Well, in our next segment, we're going to talk about what a smashing success Super Tuesday was in the state of Utah. I'm with Shireen Gorbani and Dan McKay. This is Natalie Gochner. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gorbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the political center, and you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. We've been talking about Super Tuesday, and I am so excited that Utah had a successful inaugural opportunity with Super Tuesday. The numbers are in. It was the highest voter turnout we've had in our presidential election history. We had dozens, it seemed like, of candidate visits. That engagement's good.
It's awesome.
It was convenient, vote by mail.
Yes.
It's just a real success.
It was a real success, and a huge shout out to Representative Patrice Arendt, who worked very hard. I know there were others who were involved in making this a state-funded election, yeah. Right?
Dan, this is where you give a shout out to
Kurt Bramble.
There you go.
Sponsored the bill and yada, 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 yada.
And then I'll give a shout out to Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cock, who's the chief elections officer, and to Sherry Swenson and other county clerks.
Yes.
And the political parties for having a successful election. If I remember right, Dan, I want you to correct me. Shireen and I've already talked about it, and we weren't sure, but I think the legislature spent appropriated $3 million for Super Tuesday.
That's
is that right?
Right. Yep.
Perfect. That is such a small price to pay for the level of engagement, personal contact, excitement, the lessons that are learned in conversations with young people.
We just need it to be ranked choice, and I think we'll be good.
Yeah, that's cool. Anything else you guys want to say about Utah Super Tuesday? And if not, we'll move on to some other topics.
I say we stay on this for a while to keep Shireen from being unhappy later on in the episode.
Well, why will I be unhappy? Is it your legislation?
Could be.
Could
you
be.
Guys are on two different sides of the aisle. Hey, can we talk about coronavirus for a minute?
Yes, we should.
Yeah. We talked about that in earlier programs. It's now becoming very real. Dan, give us some sense of what they're doing on Capitol Hill
to this. I'm not shaking anyone's hand, and we're, trying to stay that way. This is the first legislative session where I have not been, like, physically ill.
Okay.
So some would say mentally ill. That's an issue.
Okay.
I felt great. I mean,
are they appropriating money? Extra money? Different money?
We are looking at as trying to fit it into the budget somehow. Obviously, it is a general fund issue, and so trying to figure out how we deal with it from a general fund standpoint, but we have been talking at the Senate side.
And I can see this in two ways. One is to deal with the public health emergency that it would require, but another one to deal with a global recession that would change your revenue forecast in FY 21, 22.
Yeah.
Are you looking at both?
Looking at both,
okay.
Yep.
Shireen?
So we are getting regular updates from the Health Authority for Salt Lake County, our health department. And
public health is real at the county health department level.
Very much so. Yeah. And I think some of the things that are important for people to understand is that this is not a time to panic. Really, it isn't. But it is important to start taking some steps that we should probably be taking all the time. Really good hand washing practices, making sure that you're catching a cough, in an elbow, or making sure that we're not, if you're able, and I understand this isn't possible for everybody, but if you can stay home and you're not feeling well, please do that. But also maybe just having a little extra in your house, being ready. A little extra food supply is not a bad idea in times like this, but it's really important for people not to panic.
Yeah. I want to speak at it from an economist's perspective and just say that, we came into this situation, this public health situation, with an economy that was not strong. Okay, the trade wars, different things have just slowed the economy. Manufacturing had been down, Europe's down. So then you get this coronavirus, and all of a sudden the transportation sector gets impacted, the tourism sector gets impacted, global trade gets impacted. You have less productivity because we're all spending time on it, which takes us away from other productive functions. You saw what happened to the stock market last week. You know, they were pricing in, they were discounting their concerns about a global recession. And I think it changed everything in terms of the forecast. I think you now go to more like 50-50 odds of a global slowdown instead of like a 20% odds.
Yeah.
So I just throw that out. That's not on the public health side, but viruses that are this contagious and are causing this much public outroar will be pretty interesting. And I don't know what you guys are hearing as elected officials, but if I had a best guess, late March, we're starting to feel it and see it here in Utah.
Interesting. And the reason I is your background experience in HHS, right?
Yeah.
And so you were at HHS when bird flu.
That's right. Is 2005. It's the avian flu. It's the bird flu. And I learned a few lessons in that, you know. So you're in the secretary's office each morning. You're getting briefings from the CDC. I remember the first briefing, the CDC telling us we had like 12 cases of avian flu in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how does the CDC know about 12 cases in Vietnam?
In Vietnam, of all places.
And then a week later, they would say, we've now got, 26 cases in Vietnam. They're all, bird to human in the contraction. And so they don't worry about that.
Yeah.
When it becomes human to human, then it becomes a problem. Mm. And then I remember a few more days go by, a week goes by, and then the CDC's in saying we have our first human to human transmission. We're concerned. But anyway, what I share with that is the career professionals in the CDC, the National Institutes of Health, the National Health Service, they're amazing.
Yeah.
Our country's in very good hands. And then the second thing I learned is that preparation really means something. It matters. And if listeners will remember, the avian flu never really made it to the U.S.
Yeah, that's right.
Because of the public health measures that were taken.
Yeah.
So, and obviously, IHC has a special center at the IMC, which is there in Murray, that they are actually housing one patient that we know of.
Yeah.
And, it's the interesting part is, as you try and follow the fatality rates compared to like your average, seasonal flu, they're still saying on average, the seasonal flu is worse than this is, for
most
people.
In
the number of deaths, from a fatality standpoint.
Not in the contagion.
But not in the contagion, right? And the spread element, right? And we also don't have the ability to inoculate for it yet.
Right.
So anyway, I think there's a lot more to come on this news. And hopefully it's one of those things that comes in that we were, we were prepared for and ready to move forward.
Shireen, Dan and I always hate to talk about interest rate reductions on this program because it gets a little nerdy, but we did have the Fed reduce interest rates this week in an emergency session, and they did it by 50 basis points. Usually they would do like 25 basis points. Yeah. So this was a very unusual move and showed the level of concern.
Yes.
So, it's a virus or a pandemic. We got lots going on.
Since we're wonky on rates and since we're talking Fed, the interesting part is in the U.S., we've never used negative interest rates. In other words, where we're basically paying people to
take
money.
Now he's going really wonky.
Right?
I feel like we're just trying to dodge talking about what you're doing to women's bodies.
No, I'm happy to talk about that.
Let's do it. Let's do it. We're in the legislative session. We've got some abortion restriction bills. There's three that are of note. One would have healthcare providers bury or cremate fetal remains. Another one would have a woman have to view an ultrasound before performing an abortion. And then there's a third... I'll say Representative McKay.
Senator.
Oh, sorry. You got a promotion. You got a promotion. I should let you just explain it, but would outlaw elective abortions once the Supreme Court allows that?
Yeah, that's what the bill does. And it's when you compare it to like other states, like Alabama is just a straight out ban regardless of rape, incest, or whatever, whatever may have caused the pregnancy. Utah has an exception. It just says we've maintained our historical exceptions and we're going to keep that in effect as of today. So the idea that, that it could be banned and that we might be a society that's ready to move forward without abortions, I'm in.
So I would love to hear you talk about what you think it does when abortion does become a crime. We've had those periods of history in our own country. And what we know is that people continue to seek abortions in very unsafe ways.
So just remember though, the bill doesn't have a crime element in it for the mother.
No, but
right? So it is for
providers.
doctors and, or if any private citizens took it upon themselves to offer abortions, they would be guilty of a crime.
And do you think that's the best way to help reduce abortions?
Absolutely, it is one of the tools to reduce abortions, but you've also seen SB 74. So mine is SB 174, and then 100 bills earlier. Derek Kitchen has a bill that allows for the state to apply for a waiver for up to 250%, I think.
Are you supporting?
Oh, yeah, I voted for it.
Okay, because you were a little lukewarm last time we talked about it.
Let me tell you what the bill does, though.
Yeah.
So SB 74 would allow for a state waiver to use Medicaid funds to provide birth control for people up to 250%.
Which is fantastic. Yeah, and I'm so grateful that my senator brought that forward. Not particularly grateful for what you're bringing forward. Yeah. And I think the thing that I think about is, of course, my own reproductive health. And since you asked, basically, by passing this or introducing this legislation, I just like to talk a little bit about what it feels like for me, right? So the first time that I had unwanted sexual experience, I was a child, so I was unable to get impregnated. I was too young for that. But just 3 years later, I potentially could have been. And I think about how terrifying that would have been for my family. But I didn't report. I never told anyone that I'd been sexually violated as a child. And most people don't report rapes, right? I believe your legislation requires that there be some sort of report filed with it so that we have to know that there was rape for that to count as rape. That's terribly distressing to me.
It's in the code now, by the way.
That's a problem for me now. And then also as a person who's had two pregnancies, one that resulted in my 5-year-old and the other that resulted in a miscarriage, I'm also deeply troubled by the idea of having to bury fetal remains. For me, that was a terrible experience. It was, days and days of heavy bleeding. But if it wouldn't have passed on its own, then I potentially could have been in a situation where I was seeking help from a provider who would have had to perform what is under the law abortion. And it was an unviable fetus. And I think all of these things are just deeply problematic from my own perspective of having been a person who's tried to bring life into this world. And when I think about the things that we could actually do that would reduce women seeking abortions, and we can do a lot. And I think, you know, your support of the family planning waiver is really important. But I also think we have to talk about the fact that this is a difficult state for women to live in. When we think about the wage gap that people are experiencing, when we think about the lack of access to childcare, when we think about really the difficult decision that have to be made between a healthcare provider and a woman when it comes to this issue, I'm just deeply distressed by your insertion of yourself, you know, into that process. And I'd love to hear you talk about what other medical decisions you think the law should be a part of.
Yeah, I think that's great. One, I want to say thank you for sharing that, because honestly, I don't want to discount your pain or, you know, anyone's pain, candidly, right? In
hard
your
to
situation,
hear that with the legislation.
No, I understand. It is hard not to internalize any of this stuff. I totally get it. If you would like a recitation of the two volumes of code where we go into what you can and can't do as a doctor, I would gladly make time for that on a different episode. We have a lot of regulations related to the medical relationship, doctor-patient, doctor insurance company, yada, yada, yada. So
and
instead
of
doing
those
that...
are directly resulting in an impact only on women?
Well, again, you're calling out and saying that that is aimed at one. If I could carry a baby and that was the way science and or God created me,
it's not.
Then I'm down. It's not, right? So the hard part is, I understand it feels like it's aimed that direction.
Really,
I'm aimed at the baby, right? And so wherever the baby is, that's I'm trying to take care of the baby. So and I know everyone says, well, it's not a baby. Okay, fine.
I'm not going to argue that. What I'm going to say is that I feel like there are so many things that we could be doing around good public health policy that could actually reduce and good financially, right? Like good things, good decisions that we could be making that would really help families make this decision to keep children or to make sure that they're planning their families as they need to be. And to see that kind of mandate come forward is really distressing for me.
I find it difficult after a really serious and heartfelt discussion like that to jump over to the Inland Port or to Mayor Mendenhall's, you know, State of the City address or whatnot. But maybe just to our listeners, this expresses some of the, you know, differences between the two sides of the aisle.
And frankly, a lot of the time we agree. And I, you know, appreciate that. And this is one that just feels so deeply important and deeply personal to me. So I appreciate the time.
Yeah.
What else do you want to talk about?
We love you, Shireen. I do.
Well.
Yeah. And I will say, you know, sensitive topics are discussed all the time on the Hill. I felt badly. You know, Senator Robles ran an amendment on the bill that I think kind of got mischaracterized about how
it
was.
Didn't feel right to me either.
And then the amendment didn't land the way it was. And then I made a joke that made it even worse.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just a bunch of stuff that I was like, you know, the crazy thing about this debate is everyone likes to kind of get into their camp and stick in their camp for a public policy standpoint. And I probably am there as well.
Yeah, and that's where I'm not. Yeah. I'm really interested in the things that we can do to really improve people's lives, you know, reproducing people's lives, to make the kinds of decisions that they need to make so they don't have to get into that situation.
Yeah.
But I also just don't believe it's my job to tell anyone.
Yeah.
We're going to skip gripes today, but we're going to say thank you, listeners, for listening. I've been with Shireen Gurbani, Dan McKay. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening.